almost five years ago now, I had an experience that changed my perspective on everything. If I were a religious person, I'd call it an awakening. I found myself at 41 years old, standing in the kitchen of a house that I owned, a duplex that I bought, that I had moved my mother and her husband into. And my mother, for her entire life, has been poor. And for years, decades even, I had been bailing her out of back rent, saving her from homelessness by paying off landlords that she skipped out on, paying off bills so she could get her utilities turned back on. And I thought to myself, I'm the oldest here, and my mother is never going to be above the poverty level. This care is going to fall to me, so probably best to do it in a way that'll make financial sense. So I decided to buy a second house that was in foreclosure. It was a dump of a house that I had to renovate, and it was a duplex. So what I did was I put money into it and got it habitable, put two comfortable apartments in it, and the goal was to allow my mother to live in the upstairs apartment at a below market rent and rent the downstairs apartment out at market rates. And so in this way, I could make sure that as she got older, she was living on one floor, she was in a rent controlled situation. We weren't going to have these ups and downs and tragedies and last minute breathless crying phone calls that had been coming my entire life. Once she moved in, everything went downhill within a period of 2 years. I had forgotten what it was like to be around my mother constantly because from the time I was 12 years old, when I was taken out of my house and put into basically a glorified orphanage, a group home institution setting, I'd lived with my mother and I'd kept her at arm's length, and I moved away and I went to college and I tried to build a life that was entirely separate from and above the existence that I grew up in, which, in a word, was poor white trash. And then I brought my mother back into my life at age 41, and I had her in a house I was living with. And I had forgotten in the intervening years how deeply disturbed she was. And it quickly became apparent that this wasn't going to work out. When you have a parent like my mother, you end up being in the role of the parent yourself when you're the child. I mean, there's a technical term for this. People call it parentification. It's one of the ways that some parents can abuse children. And it starts very early, and it means putting adult responsibilities on the child. And these can be ordinary everyday things like cooking, cleaning, working for money, giving up your paper route money for the family's grocery bill, taking care of the younger kids. But it also means emotional caretaking. And one way to describe it is my mother made me her surrogate husband. She depended on me for emotional support. She poured out her heart and her intimate secrets to me from a very young age, and some of them so highly inappropriate, they're just boundaries you should never cross with your child. So I have been in the caretaker role with my mother for my entire life that I can remember. And I stood there in the kitchen one night, and I could hear my mother in the other room with her husband screaming, "What the hell is wrong with you? Are you retarded? Get out of my fucking way. Stop messing up my stuff. Why can't you just get what I asked for at the store without me having to tell you 16 fucking times?" I froze. I felt like a mouse. I froze. And I did something that brought me back to being 10, 11, 12 years old. I was stirring my coffee and I had a spoon in my hand. And I looked at the spoon and I set it down on the counter very, very slowly. I had to make sure that the spoon did not click or make a rapping noise when I put it down, very carefully. And when I did that, something turned in me, and I saw myself from the outside, and I said, "You are a 41-year-old man standing in the kitchen of a home that you owned and that you renovated, and you are putting the silverware down absolutely silently so that your mother won't scream. This is just like when you were growing up. And I knew that I had to put a stop to this. Because what had been going on for the 2 years that she was there was driving me toward what people call a nervous breakdown. My mother would text me dozens and dozens of times a day, call on the phone. Sometimes she'd be crying. Sometimes she'd be screaming. Sometimes she'd be screaming at me. Sometimes she'd be screaming at her husband. I had to fix every single problem, and I had to fix it right now. So she couldn't pay the phone bill. Josh, I have to do something. Help me, help me. What am I going to do? If the light was out on the porch, she'd call me up and be terrified that she wasn't going to be able to see an intruder who might be getting into the house and da-da-da-da-da. Everything was a crisis, and it was a crisis that had to happen right now. And these texts and these phone calls were coming at all hours of the day and night, but especially when I was at work during the day. I was so distracted from my job that I did a terrible job at that time. And I ran out to that house. I drove 40 minutes every single time. She wanted me to lift a finger about something, and it had gotten to the point where I felt like I had to choose between trying to live on tranquilizers or puking my guts up from anxiety every day. I could not keep myself together. And I thought, what's wrong with her? Is she going into early dementia? Is this Alzheimer's? Is this a cognitive decline? And at this point, I wasn't fully awake. I was still rationalizing to myself normal reasons for why my mother was the person that she was. But in actual fact, this is the same woman she's ever been since I can remember having memories from childhood. And I called my sister, because my sister had been in my mother's life for a long time. All those years that I had moved away, gone to college, started a career, my sister had stayed in the same town with my mother and had been at her beck and call. And so she'd been there all those years. And I said to my sister, something's really wrong with Mom. And I can't fix it. I don't know what it is. What she's saying doesn't make sense to me. The things she's complaining about sometimes, they don't seem real. And when I give her an answer, when I fix a problem for her, there's just another problem. And I don't know what to do. And we talked a little bit, and we ended up asking my mother to take a cognitive test, the kind of dementia test that you give to somebody when you think that they may be going into cognitive decline with something like Alzheimer's. This did not go over well, as you can imagine. And it really was at that point. This was done out of concern, but it was done out of concern for the situation, but also concern for my mother. If she'd had something going wrong, if she was in a cognitive decline, I wanted to get on top of it, and I wanted to make sure that everything would be in place to accommodate that situation from the get-go so that we weren't trying to bail ourselves out of a problem later. Well, she passed the cognitive test, and that was an opportunity for her to say that I was hallucinating things that were wrong with her, that I was overly critical, that I might have something wrong with my brain, that I was imagining things, and repeated theme with my mother. You have a very vivid imagination, Josh, she would say. And it continued to get worse. And then I began to get scared that she was going to hurt her husband. When you would call my mother, you could hear her screaming at him in the background. I mean, I've told you a few snippets of this already. But it got to the point where my sister was texting me screenshots from my mother's phone where my mother was threatening to break my stepfather's head open with a metal frying pan. And she was bragging to my sister that she'd picked up that skillet and thrown it across the room and put a hole in the wall of my apartment. And she said, well, at least it wasn't his head. And she seemed to think this was funny. I didn't think it was funny. And I called my sister again. I said, "What's wrong?" And she said some magic words to me that changed my life. "Josh, I think our mother is a narcissist. I think she has a personality disorder." I had barely heard of personality disorders at that point. I wasn't quite sure what they were. But I went to the internet, and I got some books out, and I began to read voraciously. And within 2 or 3 days of looking over the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, domestic abuse survivor support groups, forums for children who are estranged from their parents, everything slotted into place. The world became clear to me almost instantly. Everything I had tried to find an answer for that I couldn't about my mother finally made sense. I knew my entire life that she was extraordinarily sensitive and thin-skinned, that she had a volatile temper. At one minute, she could be telling a bawdy, raucous joke and laughing her head off. And then literally a few seconds later, she would be in hysterical tears, hitching and sobbing and crying and saying she didn't have anything to live for. And then she'd be back to laughing. And the term borderline personality disorder and its description summed up my mother in a way that I had never been able to sum her up before. All of a sudden, that thing that's wrong with my mother, that I don't know what it is, that she's so sensitive, that you have to walk on eggshells around her, that I can't explain to my friends, and that's why I don't invite friends to come over, because I'm scared and ashamed of what they'll see if they see my mother the way she really acts. All of this finally made sense. This is about cluster B personality disorders. Personality disorders are a kind of mental illness that's not the kind of mental illness you probably think. When we talk about mental illness generally, when people use that term, they're usually talking about things like clinical depression or pathological anxiety. And I don't just mean sad on one day and really nervous before a speech. I mean pathological and clinical. Real clinical depression, real clinical anxiety. That's usually the kinds of things we mean with mental illness. And of course, you know, the very famous one, schizophrenia, when people are not actually in touch with reality. They are quite literally psychotic. They might be hearing voices. They might be having visual hallucinations. They might be under an extraordinary delusion that somebody is out to get them. Personality disorders are not like those other things in some key ways. They are what they say on the tin. They are personality disorders. They're not a dark cloud that comes over a normal person's life and makes her sad or depressed for a week or 2 weeks or a month. They are the core components of her personality, who she is, her character. Another term for personality disorders is character disorders. These are inflexible, long-standing patterns of relating to other people that are fundamentally pathological. They're not amenable to drug treatment the way some depressions are and the way some anxiety is. They are technically, some of them anyway, treatable, or so many mental health clinicians will say. And I think there's some evidence for that. But what's important to understand is they're not treatable, just as they're not passing depression or passing anxiety. They're much deeper and more deeply rooted than that. Any chance at treatment is much smaller, because these are deeply, deeply ingrained parts of a person. The moods, the reactions, the way they process information, the way they try to make sense out of the world is fundamentally distorted in a way that is obvious to other people. Not always. Some of them are very good at covering it up. But most people who have severe personality disorders, and the ones I'm talking about are called cluster B personality disorders. It's an American diagnostic scheme. There are cluster A, cluster B, and cluster C. And a number of different personality disorders are lumped in under those clusters. I'm talking about cluster B. These are known as the erratic or dramatic personality disorders. There are four of them. They're called borderline personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and antisocial personality disorder. And antisocial is what you know as sociopathy or psychopathy. Same thing. What they share is that they are erratic and dramatic, but they also share a fundamental narcissism. Even though one of those four personality disorders is specifically called narcissistic personality disorder, that doesn't mean that the other three that don't have that name don't have narcissism. They do. Narcissism and a preoccupation with your own needs and feelings to the point where you cannot see the subjective needs and feelings of other people. You don't have empathy for them. You don't care about what happens to them. If you have a conscience, that conscience isn't really accessible to you. That is what binds these four together. They're not all the same, but they're also not entirely different either. I wouldn't even say they're cousins. They're more like fraternal twins, right? Or close siblings. Somebody with borderline could have a lot of narcissistic traits. Somebody who is mainly histrionic could have a lot of borderline traits. And we'll talk about what those specific traits are as we go along. But this is what cluster B personality disorders are. And very few people who have these personality disorders understand or accept that there is something wrong with them. That's one of the things that makes them so frustrating and so difficult to treat, because part of the condition itself is the belief that nothing is wrong with you. It's not you, it's everybody else. If you didn't pay your rent on time, it's because your boss is a bastard who won't pay you a living wage. It's not that you didn't go to school and look for a better job. It's not that you're just having a hard time this month. No, your boss is out to get you. He's a fucker, you know? Or it's hysterical overreaction to frustrations that most normal people would take in stride. So a borderline, for example. And by the way, I think my best guess here is that my mother is comorbid. I believe that she has both borderline and narcissistic personality disorders, and it's a particularly toxic combination. But it's very, very hard to treat these because the patient is highly unlikely to believe that there is anything wrong with her. And if you suggest that that is the case, you will usually be, she'll not only reflect it back at you, but she will go on the attack. She will abuse you and scapegoat you. I mean, when I was dealing with this, the fallout from my mother, you know, I would get these insane rambling emails. One of them was 5 pages single text that came in at 4:30 in the morning. And she called me a narcissist. She diagnosed me with narcissistic personality disorder. She suggested that I was sociopathic. They reflect what you say back to them. It's not me, it's you. So very few of these people are going to admit that there's something wrong with them. And if they end up in therapy, they usually end up in therapy because obviously they're having problems. They're having problems keeping relationships together. They're having problems keeping a job. They're having problems keeping friendships. But it's not usually clear to them what kind of problem they have. My mother, for example, has always been a depressive, has always had clinical anxiety. I share these things too. And we'll talk about this too. Part of having your eyes opened to what is pathologically mentally wrong with a parent or a spouse is that you also have your eyes opened to those problems in you. I share some of the problems that my mother has. I don't think they're nearly as severe. But no child who grows up in a crazy house like my siblings and I did, none of us get out of that completely intact and completely sane. Trauma lasts. And there may have been a point in my life, particularly in my early 20s, but for years after that, when it might have been a fair cop to diagnose me with borderline personality disorder. I don't think that's the case now. I've done a lot of work, and age changes a lot of things. But it's important to understand that most people who genuinely have a thoroughgoing cluster B personality disorder are very unlikely to get better. They're very unlikely to change. And some therapists and mental health workers strongly disagree with that, or they get a little upset when people like me say that. I have a discussion going on. I see a therapist twice a month. I'll call him Jay. Jay, my therapist, has challenged me on this several times. He says, I've seen borderlines recover. I've seen people with narcissistic tendencies get better. And he's right about that. But here's what I would add to it. In order for a person with a severe cluster B personality disorder to make lasting and long-term change, they have to be willing to accept some very, very challenging truths about themselves. Things that feel like, well, they feel deeper than an emotional wound, acknowledging those kinds of truths that there's something wrong with your character, right? There's something wrong with your personality. It's very, very hard to hear. Would be hard for anyone to hear. But on top of that, many therapists are not deeply trained in the kinds of trauma that usually helps create these personality disorders. And many therapists, at least in my experience, are too Pollyanna-ish. They approach their clients as if everyone were a so-called normal range personality, right? So a person who generally has a well-integrated sense of identity. They don't question who they are. They're not excessively fickle. They can weather life's storms with some measure of equanimity. And when they make bad mistakes and when they hurt other people, generally they'll realize that and they'll want to correct course. That's what most people are like. Most people are fundamentally decent. People with personality disorders are a different story. And I mean, my mother's an example. She's been on a therapist couch for decades. And of course, I have no idea what she says to her therapist, but she had one for almost 14 years that she just loved and would constantly praise. And I have to believe that either this woman was the most sainted mental health clinician who knew that my mother had severe and comorbid borderline and narcissistic personality disorder, or and was hoping that maybe this long-term therapy would finally bring my mother to some sense of enlightenment, or, as I think is more likely, she was probably enmeshed in my mother's self-pitying presentation and probably believed that she was a woman who was extraordinarily put upon by the rest of the world and had never done anything to deserve it. So it is possible for people to change, but what I really want those of you listening to understand is personality disorders, especially cluster B, they're not changeable quickly and to the degree that you can see somebody who might respond well to talk therapy or pharmaceutical therapy for a bout of clinical depression or anxiety. It's very unlikely that the cluster B in your life is going to change. It happens, but it takes a combination of things that just don't come together that often. And I'm going to draw a line in the sand here and stake my position out. This show is not a safe space for borderlines, narcissists, histrionics, or sociopaths. This is not a Cluster B affirming podcast by design. My job is not to flatter personality disordered people. It is not to do apologia for them. I don't care about that. I'm not their therapist, and I don't have that obligation. That's one of the things that we're going to talk about a lot on this show, the inappropriate social expectations that seem to be current now, that we are responsible for everybody else's feelings and that we have to take this sort of quasi-therapeutic stance where we make sure never to offend someone and never hold a mirror up to their bad behavior. That's nonsense, and I'm not going to have it. But while I don't want to discourage people who may be suffering, for example, from borderline personality disorder, I don't want to discourage them from seeking help. Because as somebody who, as terrible a person as my mother is, I can see that she's suffered. Her children suffered, I think, a hell of a lot more. But she certainly suffered, and people with these unstable personalities do suffer. And to the extent that anyone can get help and get a handle on that, I am all for it, and I want to see that happen. And as somebody who has struggled with at least traits of borderline and histrionic behaviors, I have some sense of how difficult that can be. But I had to cut contact with my mother. She's too far gone. And I've had to cut contact with other people who would not take responsibility for the state of their mind and continue to blame it on other people because they're toxic. They are poisonous. They do things that, if you will, hurt their soul and make it smaller. And they hurt your soul and make your soul smaller too, even if they don't mean to. Some of them do mean to. Let's not beat around the bush here. Some people are quite deliberately manipulative and calculating and cruel. Lack of empathy is a bitch, right? So I'm not going to be apologizing for the things that I say about Cluster B personality disorders. I'm not going to help raise awareness of people suffering from borderline. I mean, even the terminology that we use about this betrays the way that these people have enmeshed us in their abuse dynamic. We always speak of someone who suffers from borderline personality disorder or someone who suffers from narcissistic personality disorder. Do you know who suffers from borderline personality disorder? That person's husband, his wife, her children, your employees. We suffer. These people are dangerous. Whether they are physically violent and abusive, the way my mother and my stepfather were, or emotionally abusive, as my mother certainly was, and that many people with these disorders are, they are dangerous. And if they wake up, if they find a helping hand out of that psychological trap and they begin to develop some self-awareness, God bless them. But that's not my job. My job is to help people, I think, see these patterns of behavior so that you are better able to detect the difference between a friend or a colleague or a lover or a boyfriend or a potential spouse who's going through a hard time and may need extra psychological support, and the kind of person who has a really distorted and deranged character that is very unlikely to change. Because this is the kind of character that you find in violent husbands, in abusive mothers, in toxic bosses who backstab and sell their employees down the river. These are not people having a bad day, okay? They're not just having a panic attack and are going to think better about it tomorrow. This is the pattern of how they live their life. And if you allow them to get close to you and get sucked into it, and I was sucked into it for my entire adulthood, I'm 46 years old now, and it took me until 41 or 42 years old to see this. You're going to be in for a world of hurt, and I'm not going to call it something lighter than it is. I want to say a couple more things about the personal revelations I've been talking about before I move into how I began to see these dynamics operating in the broader society. I don't know any way to illustrate these points without connecting the dots from my personal experience. So I'm going to be sharing things on this show that probably sound confessional. And the aim here is not to write my memoir on the air. It's not to gin up sympathy. I'm not asking people to respond. And people do this a lot when you talk about these experiences, and it's kindly meant, and I don't mean to dismiss that kindness, but I'm not looking for, oh, I'm so sorry that you went through that, or, you know, what a terrible thing. Yes, all these things were terrible, absolutely terrible, and they were scarring, but that's not the point. They happened. The point is the lessons that I learned from them, and they're lessons that I would like you to learn as well, whether you are learning them through listening to my story, because what I'm describing to you is the experience of millions of people. This is the experience of millions of abused children. This is the experience of millions of battered wives, abused husbands. My story is not unique. Most people don't fully disclose the kinds of things that went on in the house that I grew up in, but I had to face the truth about my mother and about the sickness that runs through our family. She's not the only one in my family with this problem. I think her mother probably also had borderline personality disorder, and both of her parents were heavy alcoholics, and they were poor. And her father died when she was 11 or 12. Her mother was an alcoholic and promiscuous and would sometimes leave the children at home uncared for while she went out and painted the town red, as my mother would say. So for all of my mother's faults and for all that she's broken, she came by it honestly. But so insofar as I talk about these things, it's because I believe in the power of confronting the truth and refusing to lie. Because I spent most of my life lying about my family, to myself primarily, but certainly to the outside world. There were people, there are friends who I think could see my mother more clearly than I could. But I used to talk about my mother as this incredibly strong, intelligent woman who was a single mother, had gotten herself out of violently abusive marriages, had kept her family together, and was shit on by the entire world, but taught me all these valuable lessons. And she did teach me some valuable lessons. Nobody is all bad, right? But a lot, the most important lessons that I really take from my experience with my mother were not the ones that she wanted to teach me. They were how to heal from the distorted picture of reality that she commanded and demanded that her children live in. I can't live in lies. I won't do it. And when this all came to a head in 2016, and the quick spoiler ending of the story is I had to take my mother to court and evict her from my house. It was the darkest year of my life. It was darker than the early heart attack I had at age 36. It was like a nightmare come true. It was the kind of feeling that you get. Think about an Alfred Hitchcock movie. He pioneered that famous camera technique of dollying the camera back, pulling it away from the actor while the lens zoomed in so that you could see the person, but the proportions started to distort. Everything was real, but the relationship between everything suddenly changed. It felt like that. If that were an emotion, that's what it felt like. And it quickly became obvious to me that the same sorts of distorted and disordered thinking were going on in the political and social world that I lived in, which was what we now call social justice activism. I had long been a leftist and a Democrat. In fact, I've even talked about this in writing, that my experiences at my mother's knee, her being a single mother on welfare, who did at one point go back to school to try to better herself, but then let it fall apart again. I've often talked in the past about how that set my politics, how seeing the disadvantages and the struggles that single mothers go through made me a strongly partisan Democrat, very much for the welfare state and for higher minimum wages and all the things that go along with that. My views are more complicated now. But at that time in 2016, I was still swimming around in the SJW world. I got very involved with atheist activism that became popular in the early 2000s when Richard Dawkins's book, The God Delusion, came out. And then Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and several other prominent people who were really making a cultural splash by talking about being out of the closet unapologetic atheists. As a non-believer myself, and I'm still a non-believer, this appealed to me. And at the time, I thought it appealed to me primarily because atheists were an oppressed or derided minority. And I do think it's true, actually. There are a lot of misconceptions about non-believers, but a lot of the claims about oppression and and all of this other stuff that I believed in and imbibed and then regurgitated back out were just extraordinarily over-dramatized and distorted. But this had become my community, and there was a certain point, and I'm going to say it was probably around 20, somewhere between 2012 and 2015, where a new idea came along called Atheism Plus. And this was the idea that being a non-believer wasn't enough. You also had to engage in good works for the betterment of society, that if atheists wanted to get a better reputation on the street, so to speak, then we needed to be known for caring about something bigger than ourselves, right? We don't have God, but we believe in humanity. And so we should be foregrounding our concern for issues of social justice. And these were in the days when the term social justice itself didn't provoke the kind of reaction that it provokes in people like me and might provoke in you. It was still able to be said unironically. I didn't realize that we were on the road to hell, so to speak, but we were. And from that time forward, the so-called new atheist community began to become more and more doctrinaire about what sort of politics you had to have if you were going to be a good person. So, and they weren't articulated explicitly all the time, but it was certainly you had to be a left-leaning voter. You had to be anti-Republican. You had to be for sexual liberation, and you had to be against misogyny. You had to be for feminism. You had to be pro-environment, and in all of these ways, all of these things took their most extreme forms that now we can see as almost caricatures, right? And I ate it up. I lapped it up. I mean, I used to table at conferences for Richard Dawkins on occasion. So, you know, I was really in the thick of this, and I didn't recognize it at the time. My therapist, Jay, used a phrase sometime around 6 or 7 months ago that startled me and sort of brought me up, because he said, well, that was the time when you got yourself out of the social justice cult. And I was taken aback, and at first sort of glibly offended, if you will. Cult? I couldn't be in a cult. Well, I was in a cult. And yes, I'm a pretty smart guy. And smart people are not immune to it. In fact, sometimes intelligent people are very, very susceptible, or at least just as susceptible as anyone would be. And because you get hug-boxed, right? You get love-bombed. You get a group of people who say, we are all oppressed together, right? But we are righteous, and we've got a good cause, and we're going to win this thing, and da-da-da-da-da. It's intoxicating. It's heady, especially for people like me, people who came from traumatized backgrounds, poverty, the consequences of being gay. I came out at 12 years old in 1986, which in those days where I lived was unheard of. You know, very few kids were ever coming out at that time. And I paid the price for it. You know, I got teased and bullied. Well, I was teased and bullied, most of my childhood for being a little sissy. And now I'm a big sissy. But I had all of these experiences. And one of the ways that these experiences can curdle people and turn them sour is because they push you into conceiving of yourself primarily as a victim, not as a participant, not as somebody who has agency to make choices, but as a victim. So you are always in the subordinate position in your mind. If something goes wrong for you, it's because you're gay and someone else is a homophobe, or because they don't like poor people and they're snooty, or because they're misogynist and they just hate women. It's very, very easy to build an identity as a victim, and I built an identity as a victim. And we all know this. I'm not saying anything right now that you haven't heard on other podcasts, but victimhood has a really high market value right now. You get a lot. You get paid. You get socially paid for being a victim, and that payment comes in the form of your Facebook likes, your Twitter retweets, the memes that people make out of clever things that you say. There's a very good social living to be made by being a victim. And it's practically a prerequisite for membership in the Democratic Party anymore. But something broke at around the same time I realized what Cluster B personality disorders were, and I was able to articulate for the first time that my mother was in fact extraordinarily abusive. Not just a little bit, but a lot. I began to see it happening around me. And the big thing that broke my mind open on this was the trans question. As I said, I'm gay, and I came out very early. You could call it precocious, and some of it was precocious, but like many young men, young gay men, I was also groomed by older people who should have known better. Groomed politically into activism that I was too young to be a part of and to understand. Groomed sexually and romantically, and I'm sorry, but there's a lot of that in the gay male world, even though saying that is going to get me canceled in places I probably haven't even heard of yet. Like a lot of people, I made a very easy, facile connection between the experience of being gay and the experience of what I thought being trans was, right? This is the new civil rights frontier, as Time told us with the Laverne Cox on the cover. And I couldn't see outside of it. And in the beginning, I was vastly offended that anybody would say that trans women weren't women or that trans men weren't men, because I was filtering this through the lens of my own resentment and residual fear of remembering what it was like to be a gay kid in a shit-kicker cow town with very few people on my side and the object of ridicule and sometimes physical violence. But being gay is not the same thing as whatever being trans is, and God only knows the definitions change every day now. But I used to be an enthusiastic supporter, and I said trans women are women, and trans women should have all the rights that women have, and I was not thinking it through. Here comes the obligatory disclaimer, and I've been writing this and rewriting in my head and saying, don't say this on air, do say it on air. Whatever I do, I'm probably going to second guess it. Obviously, like any reasonable and fundamentally decent person, I believe in equality before the law for everyone, regardless of race, sex, creed, sexual orientation, so-called gender identity, basic fundamental civil rights and respect, rights and responsibilities under the law. These are not negotiable for anybody. I don't want to see anyone persecuted. I don't want to see anyone fired. Some of these things happened to me in my youth. This should go without saying. But unfortunately, these kinds of disclaimers are necessary now, because if you deviate one jot or tittle outside of the prescribed narrative, you get accused of being a transphobe, a bigot, or depending on the subject matter, a racist or a misogynist. But the fact that everybody should have the same basic equality before the law does not mean that trans women are women. They are transparently men. That's what males are. And male and female are real. You should be able to dress as you like, comport yourself the way you like, dance to the music you like, wear makeup if you're a guy, wear shit-kicker dungarees if you're a girl. Any of these stereotyped ideas of what boys are supposed to like and girls are supposed to like, it all comes down to the same problems that have beset gay people. It's, you know, what some people call gender policing and what we used to call sex role stereotypes, right? Oppressive sex role stereotypes. But that's not enough, and it wasn't enough then. And it took seeing a friend be mercilessly persecuted and then driven out of a paid writing gig to wake me up out of my reverie. And I saw a good friend I saw her reputation get dragged through the mud because she wouldn't say that trans women are women. And because she said women as a sex have certain interests and certain needs that men as a sex don't. And some of these include the need for private spaces, women-only changing rooms, women-only shelters from domestic violence and rape. These are very reasonable, ordinary things that, as the writer Douglas Murray says, we all knew to be true just yesterday until we were told that we needed to forget what we knew. And for her trouble, this was somebody who was in the same social circle that I was in. She had a writing gig in the same blog collective that that I frequented and read. And I saw her called the most disgusting names on the face of the earth. Not only that, I saw her morality called into question, her ethics called into question. I saw people accuse her of violence against trans women, because these days words are violence, but violence itself is not violence. And she lost her writing gig and was the subject, the target of a smear campaign that took my breath away in the depth of viciousness and the creative torture, social torture that people engaged in with relish. People liked it. They were getting off on it, and it made me sick. And that was the kick in the face that it took. I mean, you know, it wasn't really a kick in my face. It was a kick to her. But it took seeing somebody close to me so brutalized and financially affected by this bullying that I snapped out of it. And I thought to myself, what in hell have I been saying? What have I been talking about? Why am I saying this? Why am I saying trans women are women? Why am I afraid to say men are men, women are women, people can dress and act as they like, and they can name themselves anything they like, but reality exists? And so I kicked back. And what I saw was cluster B personality disorder abuse tactics by the members of the blog community that I was a part of, the social justice community I was a part of, the new atheist community that I was a part of. I would see people who used to call me friend and that I used to call friend preening, having emotional meltdowns and temper tantrums where they got to be the star of their own passion play on social media, particularly so-called trans women who would say, you're questioning my very identity, you're questioning my right to exist. You know, you're doing violence against me. And these people against whom no one that I could see had taken any aggressive action at all. They'd merely disagreed or said, I love you, but reality is reality. And these people made up this entire histrionic psychodrama that had people eating out of their hands. People were, you know, shedding tears over their pain and saying, I know that terrible bad turf, trans-exclusionary radical feminist, that terrible turf has done these horrible things to you, and no wonder a huge percentage of trans women don't make it past 35 because they kill themselves or they get murdered. Not true. I don't even have time to caveat all the things. But I could not believe that I was looking at my friend who was a genuinely upstanding, intelligent, thoughtful person who was being viciously persecuted. I mean, I spoke to her privately. This was tearing her up emotionally. She couldn't sleep at night. And these people who were doing it, they were throwing the tomatoes at her, were crying crocodile tears and calling themselves the victim. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, this is my mother. This is exactly what my mother does. Gin up a situation in which she can star as a victim, alienate other people, scream obscenities at them, accuse them of plotting against her, lie about them, and actually try to do things that would financially harm them. I mean, my mother, for example, threatened to turn me into Adult Protective Services for not agreeing to be her marijuana source and run drugs for her addiction. It's crazy to talk about this. And to give you an idea of how disconnected from reality I was, when she first made those accusations against me, I was afraid that I would actually get locked up. I was afraid that Adult Protective Services would believe her story that I was an elder abuser. I mean, I had bought this house. I was renting it to her for an actual loss. I mean, I went into debt to the tune of more than $100,000. And I work for a nonprofit, for goodness sake. I'm not living high on the hog. I had done all this for her, and she was gunning for me. She started to call my colleagues and give plausible deniability. She'd say things like, "I'm really concerned about Josh. I wonder if he might not be taking his medicine." This woman was trying to ruin my reputation with my work colleagues. And I saw these people doing the same thing, actually victimizing somebody and then having the temerity to pretend to be the victim themselves. And once I saw it over the trans question, I saw it in so many other areas of leftist political interest, race and racism, relations between men and women, accusations of thoroughgoing misogyny lobbed at anyone, but particularly men, who questioned anything to do with the feminist agenda of the woman who was presenting it before him. All of this with reversals, and we're going to come back to this many, many times during this show. I'm going to talk about some of the terms of art that are used when talking about domestic abuse and family abuse, because they're synonymous with the tactics that are used by people who are engaging in cluster B personality disorder type behaviors. And one of them is the reversal. There's an acronym called DARVO, Deny and Attack and Reverse Victim and Offender. DARVO. The person who aggresses says that he is the victim and then convinces other people that he's been victimized and he is actually making a victim out of somebody else who's done nothing to deserve it. So I saw all of these things happening, and I didn't want to see it. I mean, it was difficult enough to come to terms with the most difficult truth that I've had to deal with. And that truth was that my mother did not love me. She did not love her children because she's not capable of love. She is fundamentally broken. This is a very, very difficult thing to accept emotionally. It's possible, but it takes a while. I didn't think anything could get as bad as that, but when I started to see cluster B and abuse behaviors happening, not only frequently, but being embraced by the left, and in fact, having these abusive behaviors labeled as authenticity, right? My mind was spinning. And it caused me to take a really hard look at the political causes I was supporting and whether they were truly the causes I thought I was supporting. So it's a little bit all over the place. There's a lot to this. And in future shows, we're going to talk about some of these topics and isolate them from each other so that each of them can be given a little bit more of an in-depth examination. But that basically sums up the origin story of this show. I became disaffected. I don't trust the authority figures that I used to trust. I don't trust the leaders, and I don't believe them. They don't lead me anymore. I don't think they are the people that I thought they were, and I don't think they're the people that they think they are. And I can't tell you, if you're wondering, what I am now. I'm not a liberal. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a libertarian. But I think many of you have probably had the same experience. You will get called these things, depending on how you answer certain questions. Certain people with a certain political bent will slot you into one category, and people who are on the opposite side of a question that you're on will slot you into the other category. I don't think it's useful to worry about it too much. I think that these labels that we give people, liberal, conservative, libertarian, whatever they are, they're a grab bag of emotional assumptions and smuggled assumptions, right? They carry many more meanings than just what's on the surface level. And my answer to anyone who says, okay, so where are you now politically? Ask me about a particular question, and I'll ask you about what you think about a particular policy. Because in the 4 or 5 years since I had my awakening, not my awakening, an actual awakening, I began making friendships and having conversations with people that I never spoke to before. I have conservative friends now I never did before. I have religious friends, Catholic friends I never did before. One other consequence of growing up in a traumatic environment is that you misidentify your enemies. You tend to praise and cling to the people that you think love you, your parents, your husband, whoever it is who's abusing you, and you misidentify other people as your enemy. You get paranoid, and you don't have good judgment. And that bad judgment and that distorted way of evaluating friend or foe caused me to live in a bubble where I spoke only to very lefty liberal people, and I really did believe that people who disagreed with me politically had something morally wrong with them. Well, the problem wasn't them, it was me. Thanks for joining me for this. Talk to you again next time. Oh, one other thing. It's time for this week's drag name. At the end of each show, I'm going to be assigning you a new drag name. And some of you will understand what drag names are, but those of you who may be heterosexual and normie, who are not au fait with a certain sensibility of 20th and 21st century gay male culture, it's really fun to make up fake drag names as if you were a performing character that have to be some sort of pun or alliteration. So I've got a list as long as my arm, and if you want to send me some, I'll gladly add them to the list if they're quality. But at any rate, attention, this is a special announcement. At the sound of the tone, your new drag name will be Aunt Tifa. Aunt Tifa, when you're not really an anti-fascist, but you play one on the internet, ask for it by name. Bing bong!